Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Candice Milford of the club's grown-up forum and your host for today. We are also welcoming our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, senior scientist Patricia Spillman. Patricia Spillman has performed research on neurodegenerative diseases for more than 20 years, much of it in drug discovery. She worked for more than 10 years in the laboratory of Nobel Prize winner in medicine Stanley Prusiner, MD, and renowned neuropathologist Stephen DeArmond, MD and PhD. She has worked with Dale Bredesen, MD, and Vargas John, PhD, as part of the Alzheimer's Disease Drug Development Network group for the last 5 years at the Buck Institute for Research on Aging in Novato, California, and recently as a staff scientist at the Mary S. Easton Center for Alzheimer's Disease Research at UCLA. A drug that was developed by the ADDN group is now in clinical trials with other candidates in discovery and preclinical stage. ADDN pursues the identification of new AD therapies at the Buck Institute. It is their thought that Alzheimer's disease is best currently addressed by altering overall health and lifestyle. Patricia.
Thank you very much, Candice. She said something really important there. And hi, I am Patricia Spillman. I'm a scientist. I'm in drug discovery. But I always say when I go to talk to people, I hope that none of you will need a drug to treat this disease. I would rather that you never develop Alzheimer's disease at all. And that's why I like to go out and give these talks. And tonight's talk is on the top modifiable risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. There are risks for Alzheimer's disease that unfortunately cannot be modified, genetic risk factors. For example, the specific mutations that lead to familial Alzheimer's disease, there's really not a lot one can do about that. There's nothing. Or the possession of something called apolipoprotein E4. We each have a type of ApoE, it's called for short. You can't change that, although it does turn out that having a healthy lifestyle can still lower the risk conferred by having ApoE4. It is slightly modifiable. But tonight, it's the modifiable risk factors, and even then, about the top nine. I changed something on my first slide. Typically, on my first slide, I have three very impressive scientific-looking images of the human brain. One is called the connectome. But I changed it tonight because I wanted to show pictures of people, because it's people who get Alzheimer's disease and people that can lower their risk for Alzheimer's disease. And these three people here are to be admired. I met the woman on the left out hiking. She's in her mid-70s. She was out hiking on her own using a map to try all sorts of new trails. And she'll appear later on a different slide, too. The man in the center riding the bike is 102 years old at the time this photograph was taken. Now, he has since passed away a few years later, but you have to give him credit. He was a figure in Long Beach, California for many, many years. I'm so inspired by that. Yeah, that's right. And Russ Kernan, a premier runner in Marin County and probably throughout the country, who's also in his 70s and who's quite an inspiration. What I really want to, I'm going to go through my talk, but as I'm talking, I would like all of you to think about victories you've had in your own personal health, how you've helped the health of others, and even your struggles. So during questions and answers at the end of the presentation, you can even describe some of that. Or if you'd like to just talk to me afterwards, I always need inspiration from the people that I talk to. And I always learn something every time I give a talk. So I hope to really benefit from your knowledge tonight as well. Well, you can't escape getting a little bit of science when I talk, but I'll try to make it as least painful as possible. Here's the human brain, and memory is largely controlled by the hippocampus. It's a portion of the brain in the center of the brain. It looks a little like a C4 horse, and that's why it's given that name. Now, to be sure, it does interact with other parts of the brain that store memories, but the hippocampus is so important in memory, and I always like to tell the story about the London cab drivers who have to remember the very elaborate streets of London, and the map is shown right here. Look at that mad tangle. They have incredible navigational skills, and they actually have a larger and differently shaped hippocampus as a consequence of that. Now, interestingly, I just heard, though, that in some areas, which in the business of cognitive description is called a domain, they actually are not as strong because they've given so much over to this navigational skill. And it tells you something about balance in life of a variety of skills, and it's really important in health as well. It's never just one thing. It's always a combination of things. The brain that you just saw a picture of course, is comprised of a lot of different kinds of cells, but the cell that we talk about the most when we talk about Alzheimer's disease is the neuron. It stores information, communicates with other cells through what we call synapses. So these cells have these beautiful long processes, and when they touch another cell, they communicate through that point of contact, which is called a synapse. And what happens in Alzheimer's disease is that those synapses are lost, and then finally that branch starts to shrink in, and then the cell body itself dies, and tissue is lost in Alzheimer's disease. There's a lot of other types of cells in the brain. They're important, too, but the neuron is the most implicated in this disease. If you look at the brain tissue from an Alzheimer's disease patient and what distinguishes it as Alzheimer's disease rather than another type of dementia, and dementia is just a general term for loss of cognitive function that leads to impairment that impedes everyday lifestyle. For Alzheimer's disease, it's the presence of something called an amyloid plaque, comprised of a little bit of a protein called A beta, and a neurofibrillary tangle. So just as I described, there's these beautiful long processes. Inside of them is something called tau, which stabilizes it. And when it breaks down, it starts to curl up like a crazy phone cord, getting all wrapped around itself, forming the tangle. So plaques and tangles are found in Alzheimer's brain. Ultimately, brain tissue starts to die and the brain shrinks. And here you can see the Alzheimer's brain on the right, a normal brain on the left. It's not a single patient. This isn't a patient that has Alzheimer's disease just on one side. But you can see how devastating it is. Again, I do drug discovery. That's not the subject of tonight's discussion. But I'll just say very briefly that little protein A beta is a fragment from a large protein called amyloid precursor protein. Precursor, that which comes before. It gets chopped up, makes A beta. But it can get chopped up or enzymatically cleaved in another way to make something called SAPP alpha. And that is actually good for the brain. So it's a bit like a dial. If you dial over one side and you get a lot of A beta, you tend to forget. If you dial over to the other side and you get a lot of SAPP alpha, memory is increased. And our drug targeted an increase in SAPP alpha, and that's how it works. Now, to be fair though, we normally forget, and we need to. We don't need to remember everything, like where our keys were last week. So it's very, very normal to have some natural forgetting, and we just want it in a sweet spot where we have plastic memory, we can learn new things, we can get rid of the old and keep it tuned up. And cleavage of APP, or amyloid precursor protein, allows us to do that. Now, getting away from drug treatment, though, what we really think in the field and at the Buck Institute is that treatment for Alzheimer's disease will be a variety of different things working together, or what we call multimodal. And it certainly will include early diagnosis of impairment. And there's a lot of studies going on, including at UCLA, where they use imaging to detect those plaques and those tangles in the living brain early on so that they can intervene and prevent later onset of disease. Health style support, of course. And you know what that's going to mean, and it's going to come up many times in this talk. A healthy diet exercise, making sure you have the right vitamin levels, and a lot of good things. And then finally, since not all Alzheimer's disease can be avoided, as people get to advanced age, the risk goes up even with a good lifestyle. It probably will require some pharmacological intervention, but even then, probably more than one working in concert to treat the disease. This talk I'm going to give today is just one of three I commonly give, and I've had the wonderful privilege of giving both of my other talks here at the Commonwealth Club. One was Output, Body and Mind, and that's about a way to embrace life to keep your brain healthy. And it's a really wonderful and, I think, fun subject. You know, always keep learning, take up a musical instrument, learn how to dance. It's the brain really loves that. And then the second one is intake, which is, of course, nutrition, which is so, so important to preserve health and cognitive function. But today, it's the top nine risk factors for Alzheimer's disease, which you will see abbreviated as AD again and again. And they are obesity, smoking, carotid artery narrowing, type 2 diabetes, low educational attainment, high homocysteine, depression, high blood pressure, and frailty. Now, I will say this was drawn from an excellently done epidemiological study. However, which are the actual top factors? This is not this numerical order does not represent the level of risk. There's a lot of consensus that these are risk factors. They are not the only risk factors, but for tonight, they're the ones I'm going to focus on. So I have smoking in orange because I don't have a slide on it. I think we'll just all agree that smoking isn't good for you. And but I'll tell you a funny thing about smoking. A lifelong smoking, especially in midlife, it puts you at higher risk for Alzheimer's disease. But quite often people who smoke, who have memory problems when they're older, have, due to the effects of nicotine, a brief improvement in memory. And so the data on it can be somewhat confusing. But there is an increased risk of developing Alzheimer's disease if you're a smoker. Well, what is risk when we talk about risk? And that is just when you put yourself in peril. And this is the funny thing about Alzheimer's disease. The single greatest risk factor that is not on this list, because I don't want it to be modifiable, is advanced age. We all want to live to advanced age. Quite often I have people at the end of these talks say, well, my parent or my loved one had a great diet and they exercised all the time and they had lots of friends and they still got Alzheimer's disease. And quite often, not always, I'll say, how old were they? And they'll say, well, 92. And how wonderful to live to such advanced age. But if you do, your risk will go up due to age alone. Second to that, even with the great lifestyle, if you have someone you know that developed Alzheimer's disease younger than that, there are risk factors we don't know about yet. There are genetic risk factors we're not aware of. There actually are genetic protective factors that people are studying as well. So while not all Alzheimer's disease can be avoided, at least you're here tonight to find about the things that you can modify. Well, obesity was certainly one that comes up again and again. And I had a really interesting discussion with a doctor before the talk. It's very hard to separate out obesity. And this is obesity in youth and midlife in particular that contributes to the risk of Alzheimer's disease. It's hard to separate that out from the actual content of the diet that leads to the development of that obesity. It could be certain things in the diet, and two different people can be obese for two different reasons. I don't have the data or accurate studies in hand right now to tell you what kind of diet that leads to obesity is the riskiest. But certainly the presence of obesity itself in youth and midlife certainly increases one's risk for Alzheimer's disease. Well, what's the answer to that? And this is sort of the format I'm using for the evening. If the question is obesity, the answer is exercise. And I know you hear it again and again. And I hope really all of you take it to heart. Get out walking. We had a great talk earlier about one of the greatest ways to get out for a walk is have a dog. have a dog that needs to be walked and walked briskly twice a day. It's so wonderful. Walk with friends, get a Fitbit. It's that was not a product placement. If there's another brand out there I can mention, I'll do it. But it's really great, and there's a biological basis for it. It increases brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and that word has all the good stuff in it. Brain-derived, it's in your brain. Neuro, neurons, trophic, which means to support or grow. Factor, it's in the brain, and it increases it. And in fact, weight-bearing exercise does as well. So in addition to what we think of as the cardiovascular exercise, walking, running, cycling, keep your muscles in shape. Lift some weights or do some strength building. It's a really great combination. Walk or hike, and what I like about this, and I like to show Kelly again, is the combination of walking and hiking with a spatial memory task. Use a map. Study trails. Combine what the brain really loves to do is more than one thing at once. So you're not just hiking, you're thinking about orienting yourself in space and time, and it's just excellent for the brain and for the hippocampus. Well, here's another risk factor, carotid artery narrowing. And of course, that's the artery in your neck. I have a beautiful picture here from Gray's Anatomy, the incredible book of illustrations of the human body. It can be treated by the placement of a stent or other surgical procedures that can clear clots. It is a narrowing or clot in that artery. Medication can help, and smoking certainly puts one at risk for it. And I know this is a little bit of a checklist, but I do want to say, because the symptoms of carotid artery narrowing can be a little bit difficult to ascertain. They can be somewhat silent early on, but they can result in a transient ischemic episode or stroke. So it could be numbness or weakness, especially just on one side, or sudden trouble speaking or understanding somebody. You could have trouble seeing. Again, it could be unilateral, just in one eye, although it could be in both eyes. Sudden dizziness or loss of balance, not chronic. And, of course, a severe headache with no known cause. Really top-notch medical care is very important here, but it's very worthwhile if you're at risk for this condition. It's going to be interesting how a lot of these risk factors sort of dovetail into each other. So another leading risk factor is type 2 or what we call adult onset diabetes. And I'll just say as an aside, this is a little different than insulin-dependent diabetes. In that case, which usually onsets in much younger people, a certain cell in the pancreas called a beta cell stops making insulin, and the patient becomes immediately insulin-dependent. In adult-onset diabetes, the cells become sort of immune to insulin. They don't recognize it anymore. They become insensitive. One of the things that leads to that is a consistently high sugar diet. The body's taking in a lot of sugar. The pancreas is making a lot of insulin. And after a while, the cell will not recognize the insulin, which is supposed to usher the glucose into the cell for usage as energy. And it just won't do that anymore. It's called insulin insensitivity. And there are medications for it. So again, it's very important that type 2 diabetes be diagnosed. Now, what is the other treatment for it other than medication? Exercise again, and also lowering the glycemic index of your diet. That means lowering the sugar in your diet. It's always a good thing. And be aware about how sugar can sneak into your diet. It's in a lot of foods. It's really great to read labels. But most of the sugar we get in our diet is pretty overt. It's in sodas or things that are maple syrup and something that's pretty obviously sugary. Lower that. Now, some adults, it runs in their families. They'll get diabetes even with a healthy diet. In that case, again, proper and consistent medical treatment will lower your risk for Alzheimer's disease. Well, this risk factor, the lower educational attainment, seems like one when you're older that you can't change, but you can always keep learning. So even if you didn't get a PhD in anthropology or what have you, you can always keep learning. And I think this is a really great one. course, what's more wonderful than learning how to play a musical instrument? And I had to show the book cover for Oliver Sacks' book. He's a very, very famous doctor and neurologist. But I think one of the most important contributions that he made to the field of cognition is the importance of music, music and memory. That was an incredible documentary, Alive Inside. I hope all of you get a chance to see it. I believe it's on Netflix now, showing how just the playing and enjoying of music again can stimulate memory in people who are apparently demented. It's really very important. Learning a skill of any sort, woodworking, art, you name it. Dancing is wonderful because, again, it is a learning skill, but it's very complicated, and it combines spatial memory with movement. Attend classes. You don't have to formally be getting a degree. There's classes available in most places. And what I call a second career. Now, in general, I give these talks to people who are older, and so they are talking about a second career. But it doesn't have to be a paying job. Of course, it can be volunteer. It can be something that has a lot of different aspects to it, and it's like a job. It's like a career. But it doesn't have to be to make a living. But it's great stimulation, especially if you're finally getting to do something that you want to do. And my father, who lived to a good age and certainly had excellent cognition until he did pass away, volunteered helping other seniors, which I thought was just, they were called Silver Seniors. It was in the Monterey Bay area. And it was seniors helping other seniors. And what a wonderful way to have a second career. Well, here's one that sounds really scientific. High homocysteine, which is an amino acid that is a result of metabolism. And it's naturally occurring. And interestingly, you can lower it by taking B vitamins or folate, and an opposite, what goes along with that is that quite often people develop high homocysteine because they're low in B vitamins. It is not uncommon. It also puts people at risk for coronary artery disease, and it has a very high correlation with the development of Alzheimer's disease. Interestingly, and maybe perhaps of concern, is that doctors don't typically ask for this on a blood test. You have to ask for it. But I think, especially if you feel you're at risk for Alzheimer's disease because it runs in your family, it's worthwhile to ask for it. It's not an expensive test, relatively, and it can be accurately done. And because it is modifiable with B vitamins, and that is the only treatment that I know of, it's very worthwhile to get it done. Depression. You know, I want to mention here, I had on my first slide that, you know, I'm representing the Buck Institute because they're so involved locally here in increasing people's health style as they age. It's the Buck Institute for Research on Aging. It's very important. But UCLA right now has a major project going on addressing depression going forward. And depression is a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. And it's also a major health problem in and of itself. I don't have a lot of good answers about how to treat depression and therefore to lower the risk for Alzheimer's disease. It is a very, very serious problem. However, there are medications that for some people are effective, and it's very important to look into it if one does have chronic and difficult to treat depression. But the support of loved ones can help somebody with depression a lot. And I really wanted to show the picture of Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks together hugging, because they represent friendship, long-term friendship, support of each other, and comedy. And comedy and humor can do so much to relieve depression. It itself is almost like a tonic. So I really wanted to show that picture. Interestingly enough, caffeine, people who consume higher levels of caffeine in coffee have less depression. However, I will say, as you get older, sometimes you can't take caffeine if you have cardiac arrhythmia or other problems. So if you tolerate caffeine well, it can be of aid. Again, this is not in any way being represented as a treatment for depression, but there is an association. Poor sleep itself can lead to greater depression and sleep impairment. And I covered this more in another one of my talks. Can lead to a higher risk of Alzheimer's disease. It may not have made it into the top nine, but it's a very serious factor, especially when it's combined with sleep apnea, which is the cessation of breathing while you sleep. Oh, I do have the dog sleeping, but there's a reason why I have a picture of a dog sleeping soundly. And that was what I like to bring up again and again. The companionship of pets is not only good to get you out exercising, but it can help people who are suffering from depression. Again, it's not a treatment, but maybe all of these things combined, good medical support, the support and love of family, humor, excellent sleep quality, and having a wonderful animal to love can help with depression. High blood pressure. Well, I don't think there's much that high blood pressure is good for. So, of course, it's on the list. It really should be treated. It puts one at high risk for kidney disease, heart disease, and, of course, here, brain disease, because it causes vascular damage, and where there's vascular damage and the tissue does not get a proper supply of oxygen and nutrients, there is an increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. There's good medication for high blood pressure. Weight loss, again, helps with high blood pressure. Stress reduction. We just had a talk here in the front about mindful meditation and how helpful that is in stress reduction. And in fact, meditation increases gray matter. It turns out lots of neurons packed together in the brain look gray. And that's what we think of as the brain looking gray. And mindful meditation preserves gray matter. There was a study showing that. And of course, exercise again. This issue of high blood pressure was so important that, and it's hard to see from where you are, there's a poster here that was put out by the National Institutes of Health. And it's sort of a comical poster, but high blood pressure, it says, is even riskier. And the image, and this is, of course, for the people who can't see, is of two sharks and a swimmer. It puts one at risk for a lot of health issues, not just Alzheimer's disease. Frailty. Now, frailty is an interesting one because it was listed as one of the top risk factors. And this frailty is, I think many of us have seen in people who are quite a bit older, particularly women, a sudden weight loss and a loss of strength. And it is a very high risk factor for Alzheimer's disease, but recent studies indicate it's actually the development of Alzheimer's disease that's leading to the loss of weight and the onset of frailty, even if memory loss isn't fully manifested yet. So in my opinion, it's a little bit of in a gray area as if it's a modifiable risk factor or not. But nonetheless, if you have a loved one, and this is a case where your support for somebody who is frail is so important because they really won't be able to do much on their own. Exercise, and that's getting somebody out to exercise. Maintaining nutrition, which can be difficult, but is very, very important. Checking bone density, and if indicated, taking one of the medications to increase bone density. There are some risks involved. This would be a decision between the individual and their patient and, of course, their family. And to just maintain any sort of activity and not get too isolated and stopping moving and just becoming very, very frail. And this really is probably the key slide to say how important it is to support the health of others, because we seem to be only about as healthy as the people around us. And there are many studies that have shown that. And I don't think it's that hard to see when you look at certain communities. For example, I had heard in San Francisco, in general, people are not overweight. They walk more. And goodness knows you have to walk hills here, right? You know, it's not all flat. there's wonderful food here, but there's wonderful healthy food here. You have options. You have, whether you believe gluten is good or bad for you, I don't think anybody thinks it's especially good for you, but you have options here, wonderful farmers markets and vegetables. And then in other parts of the country, there are problems with obesity and high sugar diet. And that's not just geography, it's society and societal acceptance of a lack of exercise and a poor diet. So anything you can do to inspire others and support the health of others is going to help your own health as well. And that's why I really wanted to put in this slide about the responsibility of taking care of one's own health. And it's an issue that I would like to talk about a little more, perhaps in another talk at another time as I develop it. Is I meet a lot of people when I go to give these talks that feel a little overwhelmed or resigned to not having good health and not being proactive about their health. And I'd like to learn out more about why people feel that, why it is they don't exercise even though they could, why it is they have an unhealthy diet and feel like it's difficult to have a healthy diet. How can we overcome that? Not just how I can help them, but how they can find it within themselves. Where do you find motivation? Where do all of you find motivation? I'd really like to know. And again, I'm going to say it again, you have to support the health of others because we get so much more done together. Now, memory loss. People come to these talks, of course, because they hear so much about Alzheimer's disease. So I do want to say a little something about that in particular at the end. Not all memory loss is Alzheimer's disease. An accurate diagnosis is very critical. A neurologist who is a colleague of mine said, before somebody offhandedly gives you a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, a disease that is an untreatable and ultimately fatal disease, you want to be sure that that is really what you have. And the methods for diagnosing Alzheimer's disease are much improved in recent years. And these diagnostics include computer-assisted tomography or the CAT scan. You look for structural abnormalities. You can even look for a presence of a tumor that can appear to be Alzheimer's disease when it's not. Something called positron emission tomography or the PET scan that can detect glucose utilization. I mentioned the use of glucose by cells in the brain. Sometimes that's impaired in Alzheimer's disease, but there can be other reasons why that happens. Amyloid imagings, do you really have those Alzheimer's plaques, the amyloid plaques? If you don't, you may have a different kind of disease and perhaps one that's more treatable. Functional magnetic resonance imaging to look for blood flow, and of course, tests, the proper tests for cognitive function. And there's a whole battery of tests. It certainly would be my advice if somebody you love or are taking care of thinks they have Alzheimer's disease to go to an expert. And there are excellent clinics at UCSF and at Stanford. Those are the local clinics. I think Kaiser has a good memory clinic, and there are certain locations of Kaiser that are very strong in that. But it's extremely important that you get appropriate diagnosis. And again, other causes of memory loss can be depression itself, an untreated infection, multiple sclerosis, low B vitamins, what they call a B vitamin crisis, can lead to temporary memory loss, chronically could lead to Alzheimer's disease, hypothyroidism, medication interactions. Older people often take more than one medication, and it can result in cognitive impairment, but that can be corrected. And, of course, tumor. The other sources of dementia are vascular dementia, Parkinson's disease, Lewy body dementia, and frontotemporal dementia. They're all slightly different, and they don't have the combination of the amyloid plaques and the tau tangles. These are just my references. So I won't go over those, but you know, everything is referenced in here. And there is a blank slide, because this is the slide that I want all of you to fill by telling me something tonight that helped inspire you to be healthy, a piece of knowledge that you discovered. And I'll give you an example of one that I added to another talk when somebody raised their hand and they said dehydration, that their father she came over and he was walking along the wall with his hands along the wall. He couldn't walk without the support of the wall. And it turned out it was dehydration. Chronic dehydration can ultimately lead to permanent impairment, cognitive impairment. And I hadn't thought about that. Quite often, older people get dehydrated because of their medications or for physical issues. They don't want to have to go to the bathroom a lot, and so they start restricting their water intake. And it was a piece of knowledge that I have now in one of my other talks, and I was so grateful for it, and I have many others. So I am at the end of my talk and ready to discuss things.
Thank you. Don't go away. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this program with the Commonwealth Club of California and you are listening to the top modifiable risk factors for Alzheimer's disease with neuroscientist Patricia Spillman. Our thanks to Patricia Spillman for her comments here today. I am Candice Milford of the Club's Grown Up Forum, and I will be monitoring today's audience question period. Patricia, I'm sure you have many. We do have someone that will be walking around with a microphone. So if you have a question, please raise your hand. The microphone will come to you. Please speak into it so our listening audience can hear.
Hi. Thank you very much for your talk this evening. I have a question for you about the B vitamins. There are so many B vitamins, and there are so many brands of vitamins, and you hear a lot about some vitamins are better than others. Can you give us some advice on how to go about selecting B vitamins to add to our routines?
A very good question, although you're not going to be as happy with my answer. In general, I would like for you to get your B vitamins in your food, leafy greens, and I showed pictures, you know, they have peanuts here and beans and other foods that are really rich. So I would like for you to increase your B vitamin intake in its natural form in foods. I will say this, though. If you do have chronically low B vitamins and you feel that you really feel like you have a good diet rich in B vitamins, but for some reason you even had your B vitamins measured and they're low, a reputable B vitamin complex should do the job. And the complex is good, where it has B6 and B12. You can also look up on different websites about which vitamins might be good. But so long as it contains the B vitamins, it should have some good effect. I can't recommend a certain brand because my belief is always in food first. Okay. Oh, he's got a...
Regarding carotid artery narrowing, was that on your list, right?
It sure was, yeah.
If you don't have any of the symptoms you listed, well, first of all, is there a test for it? And if you don't have any of those symptoms, should you have that test?
I would say typically they don't test for it. I would think it would be an imaging where they inject a dye or an ink and then they do an imaging study. That those tests are pretty, they have to be called for. Now, I don't know if one of those whole body scans reveals that it might. And sorry, that's something that I think I'll take away and I'll look into. They are costly. I think one pays for them themselves if they want to get the full body scan. But if you're absolutely symptom-free, unless you have a very distinct family history, I think it will be difficult to get the precise diagnosis for that in the absence of symptoms. So unfortunately, you do have to wait till you have a symptom of sort in general. Somebody's handing a microphone around, and he's got it.
Yes, so every year most of us have our annual physical, and you mentioned having a check for, I think it was Flonate or B9 as a part of...
The B vitamins in general, yes.
Now, is there anything, when we're going in for our annual physical every year, in addition to asking for that to be checked as a part of our blood tests, is there anything else that you can think of that we should be asking the doctor to check?
You know, there are a few things. I talk more about in another talk, but your B vitamin levels, your homocysteine level, your D vitamin levels, people who are chronically low in D3, also at higher risk for Alzheimer's disease. And those are the ones I'm thinking of right off the top of my head. If more come to mind, as we talk tonight, I'll come back to them and I'll mention them. They're not always typically things doctors look for in the annual physical. You have to ask for homocysteine. You have to ask for D3, but it can make a big difference.
When you were talking about nutrition, you suggested that there was nothing good to be said about gluten. Do you think, as a scientist, you can say that, really? I mean, it's really...
Oh, well, no, you probably heard him. Maybe it's not fair to me to say there's nothing good to be said about gluten. That was meant to be humorous.
Okay.
Definitely meant to be humorous. Gluten has been the punching bag in the health field for the last couple of years. In fact, I heard a comedian say... Oh, gluten. He said gluten is just something that's bad in general. It's not a food. Like if you fall and you skin your knee, you're like, oh, that's so gluten. You know, it's just, and I have heard, I had the opportunity to hear Dr. Perlmutter speak on it. And of course, he's very, very anti-gluten. There's some merit to that. Certainly there are people with celiac disease, and it's a disaster for them. There's many people who believe in cutting out gluten for their diet. I personally don't seem to have a problem with it, but I don't eat a lot of bread and pasta. I think it's a very personal decision about how you feel, how your body feels when you eat foods that have gluten or not. Oh, is it a scientific... Oh, absolutely. If you're allergic to it, I mean, that's a real thing. That's not an opinion. Yeah. Again, people's body, you know, it's such an interesting debate. I do eat things with gluten in it that personally, but Dr. Perlmutter makes a very strong case about it, and he's a good scientist, and I did enjoy his work. I think it's a field that bears more investigation, but you're right. It's a protein. I think the Japanese use it to make some meat substitutes traditionally, and I think they probably don't have a lot of problems with it. So, but perhaps an in-depth talk for another time. I'm not an expert on it.
We have another question here in the back.
Hi, an exercise-related question. For preventing Alzheimer's, does more exercise mean more prevention? So is running marathons or ultra marathons better than just walking?
We got an answer from the group. From what I understand, no. Extreme exercise actually can cause damage, of course, put you at higher risk for injury. And if you have an injury, you can't exercise. In particular, I've learned a lot more about exercising as you get older and how your body responds to it. So we're going to say moderate exercise, but even this, and I really believe in this, get out there and do something. Often I hear people say, well, you know, just exercising 3 days a week, it isn't enough. It has to be at least this or that. Movement, gardening, house cleaning, dancing, walking the dog, just start to add it all together. Walking the stairs, walking, park farther away in the shopping mall. It's all good. But you do not have to be an ultra marathoner to get cognitive benefits. And I don't know that there's a study out there that indicates that it's a sliding scale, but that's a really good question.
Yeah, I've been on a eating... Oh, okay. I've been following a plant-based whole grain diet pretty much. And I've heard that if you're eating gluten-free, you're not eating whole grains because it's taking something out of the bread. And so you're making a choice if that's correct. And the other thing is I've been advised that if you are going to be on a plant-based diet, that the one vitamin you want is B12 because you can't have them both.
Well, gluten has reared its neutral head again. I'm really not an expert on the gluten issue. It's not where I've put a lot of my focus. I will say that whole grains have provided nutrition to people for many millennia, and we can't, it's really been society changing, as I understand it, once we were able to farm wheat and use it. But I won't address whether the gluten should be in an additive or not. But you're absolutely right. If you have a vegan or vegetarian diet, it can be hard to get the B12 and the B vitamins.
I have a question for our grandchildren so that they can live to our age. And this is a matter of consistently high sugar diet. Is it true that early use of high sugar and high fat leads to a consistent appetite for them throughout the rest of the life? And therefore, one needs to start early on avoiding the consistently high sugar diet.
Well, I can't answer that question factually. I haven't read such a study. Intuitively, I would say there's some logic to that once the body is trained to have a very high sugar or high fat diet, that's very hard to adjust, and that would be based on all of our personal experience. We do get used to what we're raised with, and our bodies get used to it. So I think there's probably some truth to that. But again, I'm not an expert on it, nor have I read a specific study. But it's a really good issue and question.
So back to the Alzheimer's topic. So for the drug trial that you had mentioned, can you talk a little bit more about that, where that is being held and at what stage the trial is looking for people?
Well, it's for a drug called tropizetron, which is a repurposed drug. It was originally developed for nausea and vomiting, post-surgical nausea and vomiting. It increases SAPP-alpha. It's being held in Australia, because tropizetron is approved for use in Australia. There's a similar drug here in the United States called ondansetron that's approved for nausea and vomiting, and not tropizetron, not because there was anything wrong with tropizetron, but ondansetron was better at that role in nausea. So it's in Australia, and it's for something called mild cognitive impairment, which is a condition that precedes Alzheimer's disease. There are some good Alzheimer's trials running right now at UCSF and at UCLA, but of course that's not where you live. But you can look, if you go to the website for the Memory and Aging Center at UCSF, they'll probably indicate some of the clinical trials. I think a really important one right now is called the A4 study. And they're looking at people who have amyloid but no memory loss and treating them early with drugs that specifically target amyloid to see if it'll prevent the onset of Alzheimer's disease. I think that's one of the biggest innovations in the field, is not to wait until a patient is so advanced that it's hard to correct the damage, but catch it before it happens with the appropriate treatment for the appropriate condition, which is this presence of amyloid.
Patricia, you are a very considerate presenter and have left plenty of time for questions. So I want to assure everyone, we're kind of working our way toward the front. Your question will be heard. So if I live, I'll get to you before this is over. All right, so be patient. We're working our way up on this. There are lots of questions, and that's a good thing.
I did have a shorter talk with a longer question period this time. That was deliberate.
Hi. I guess my question goes on from what you said about being proactive. I have a family history of Alzheimer's. I'm 55. Don't think I have major memory loss yet. But I'm just wondering, would you recommend for someone like me, I have a fairly healthy lifestyle, but would you recommend that I go in, get tests for Alzheimer's? At what age?
Oh, no. I mean, it's there's no really not much to be gained by getting those specific tests
like
at your age.
Scan or PET
scan. No, it's quite costly, and it wouldn't be indicated, I don't think. You can follow your own cognitive function with one of these. There's brain training software, and what they do is they keep your averages, and they compare you to the averages of other people, and you can see if you're maintaining your cognitive abilities. It may not be thoroughly scientifically proven, but if you want some way to keep tabs on your own cognitive ability, that's a way. I think that you'll, if you have some impairment, that, you know, and unfortunately with some people, it can happen when they're earlier. If you have a concern, or if you have family or friends have a concern about your memory, then yes. But I don't think going in for a battery of testing is necessary if you have no symptoms at all. Yeah.
On leafy greens, I had an idea for you. We eat out several times a week, and we always order a side dish of sautéed spinach if it's on the menu. And sometimes we order it even when it's not on the menu. And most of the restaurants have some kind of sautéed greens that you can order, and they're usually very reasonably priced. I'm a vegetarian plus fish, and a lot of times on a menu I can't find anything that I really want. And a lot of times we'll just order side orders of vegetables, and it really increases the veggie intake. I was wondering what are the best sources of getting the B9 and B12?
Oh, definitely, you know, spinach. That word kale we heard so much now, but also other foods, beans, and. I hope I'm right about this. Clams, I think. Although, do shellfish fall into fish when you said and fish?
Yes.
Yeah, they can have a lot of B vitamins too.
Yeah.
I like your idea. Here's his suggestion: is if you're, and I like this, I'm going to take it to something like for the nutritional. If you're in a restaurant and they don't quite have what you think would be good or healthy to eat, ask them what they can put together for you. That's a really great idea.
Two questions. One, is there a website that lists and discusses these nine factors? And two, since memory loss isn't usually fatal, how does the disease kill you?
Oh, those are the exact top nine are mentioned in a scientific paper that I have here, and I can give you that information. It's not on a website as such, although I will say I think if you put in the search terms, topped modifiable risk factors for Alzheimer's disease, you'd pretty much get these nine or something pretty close to it. You know, there's always some debate and wiggle room. So that's, you know, as a way to remember it. And then your second question was, Alzheimer's disease ultimately is fatal. The brain will start to die off more and more, ultimately affecting the respiratory center. I think one of the common causes is aspiration pneumonia. But quite often people with Alzheimer's disease will die of other conditions because they're ill with the disease for so long that a heart attack or an infection will actually be the cause of death before Alzheimer's disease. The course can be quite long. Sometimes it's as little as 2 years, sometimes as long as 10 years. I met a gentleman whose wife had Alzheimer's disease for 20 years, and her symptoms started in her late 50s. So it can be very slow.
There's a hand in the back. Oh, yeah, with a microphone.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much. Has your research, I'm a cancer survivor, has your research indicated any correlation between high-dose chemos, stem cell transplants, continuing chemos, and memory loss? For example, as I say, you have the toxic chemos, and then you have the non-toxic chemos, just like some patients have to take a chemo, that you don't get sick and you don't lose your hair. But is there a correlation between memory loss, ultimately long-term memory loss, as a result of various types of chemo treatments?
Well, that's an excellent question. It's one I should be able to answer. I know that the way that many toxic chemotherapeutics work would indicate that they might have an effect on memory function. I don't have a study that I know of on hand. I am sure they have been done. And now, by prompting with your question after this talk tomorrow, I'll look up these studies. So I don't have that fact for sure. I would suspect, though, that since toxic chemotherapies, for example, impair cell division, that would include neurogenesis or the formation of new cells in the brain, and that can't be good for memory. So I'll look into that. Interestingly, though, I do know there had been a study showing that as people get older, they seem to be at risk either for cancer or neurodegenerative diseases, because there's sort of two different physiological states, one of sort of overgrowth and proliferation and one of under, you know, proliferation and lack of trophism. And so the system in these people is different, and that people who've had a history of cancer and survived it, you know, it's tough to do the statistics on this, might be at lower risk for Alzheimer's disease. I'm not quite conveying that accurately, but there was some thought around that. But again, since people who have cancer are often treated and treated with radiation or chemotherapy, that itself can have its side effects. I suspect at least some temporary memory loss might be part of it. I'll look into that more seriously.
So some researchers argue that the pathophysiology of Alzheimer's actually occur before the clinical signs appear. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of anxiety for those that are middle age or getting more advanced in age developing Alzheimer's. Can you talk about some of these tests, 23andMe, and its benefit for perhaps looking at your predisposition to Alzheimer's?
Yeah. If I understand this correctly, 23andMe can't reveal certain genetic information anymore legally, but you can be genotyped to see if you have the apolipoprotein E4 allele. You can ask for that. What you do with it after that is up to you. I listened to a talk at a major meeting on Alzheimer's disease indicating that regular exercise lowers the risk if you have apolipoprotein E4 to that of people who don't. So that's worth knowing. Maybe it'd be a motivating factor. Most certainly, the pathology starts developing before signs or symptoms, decades before. That's why we're here tonight, hearing a talk on lowering the risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. Each of these risks conveys an acceleration of the buildup in some way, either of the tau tangles or amyloid plaques. There seems to be, if you connect enough dots, a correlation. And so the best thing to do is to lower these risk factors, to do more tests, other than, again, the D3, the B vitamins, and homocysteine. It's hard to use a lot of our medical resources for extremely expensive tests like the amyloid imaging if there's no indication that one actually has the disease. So what we need is less expensive tests that can be done earlier.
Would you speak to the research that's currently being done on APO3 and APO4? And I believe some of that is here at the Gladstone in San Francisco.
Oh, the Gladstone, yeah, has a really strong group in that. And in fact, a few of our really best people come with that expertise from the Gladstone. I'll say at UCLA, in our drug development lab there, we have a whole series of drug targeting the effects of APOE4, specifically, in many models, to see if we can reverse those effects as they affect cognitive function. It's something I'm working on right now. So there's a lot of focus on it. And I think one of the interesting things, a study underway right now, you two have two copies of a gene, one from each parent. And everybody has apolipoprotein. It's just that there's type 2, type 3, and type 4. Type 1 basically doesn't exist anymore. You can be 2-2, 2-3, 3-3, 4. There are people who are 4-4. They have two copies of apolipoprotein E4 who live to advanced age without any impairment. What they're looking for is their genetic factors that protect them. And I love that idea. Instead of looking at everything that's going wrong, try to figure out what's special about people who never have a cognitive impairment, even though they have two copies of APOE4. And I can't wait to see the results of that study. That's a study of genome, and not just the genome, but what they call epigenetics. And that's what genes are expressed and what proteins are really made in the brain and the body to protect. So there's actually a lot of excitement. I don't know exactly what's going on in the Gladstone day to day, but we're working on drugs that address it, and a lot of other people are too.
If I could, sure. Just a follow-up
would you?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so true. You must have gone. That's excellent. You've gone to a talk. Yeah, APOE4 has a different structure than APOE3, and it has this little part that comes out. They're called structure correctors, and they're small molecules. These are the small chemical molecules that come in and correct it. So now it doesn't behave like APOE4 anymore. It'll behave more like 3. And what an excellent question. Yeah, I went to such a wonderful talk on that. A few months ago, a visiting professor came to UCLA. And how wonderful that you remembered the details of that. Structure correctors.
Hi.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, go ahead. I'm listening. Where'd she go?
Yes. I wonder if you are talking to people about research that recently has come out about hearing loss and the importance of wearing hearing aids if you have in preventing dementia.
Well, she asked about hearing loss, something that's very close to my heart because my husband has a very severe hearing loss. And we've spent a lot of time and years getting him proper hearing aids. It absolutely affects cognitive function, language skills, interaction with the world. I really think the area of hearing loss has not been as effectively addressed as other areas in medicine. So in my other talk, Output Body and Mind, I do talk about, you know, glasses, dental care. And I have a whole slide on hearing loss, getting a great hearing test, getting the best hearing aids you can. And I even try to create an environment where my husband can hear and participate. That's how I support his health. Social events, I tell people, please talk to him a lot. Don't avoid talking to him because he doesn't always understand you. It's so important, hearing loss and cognitive function. There is a correlation. It may not have been in the top 10, but it's certainly a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. Thanks for bringing that up.
Hi.
Hi.
I see that age is not on the list.
It's not modifiable.
Right.
There's only one way I know to modify advanced age.
Right. So as you know, our generation is living 10 to 30 years longer than our parents did. Does that mean that... is it inevitable? And what percentage of the population will get Alzheimer's?
Well, you know, these statistics are just for studies that probably span 10 years from 2003 to 2013. 50% of people over age 85. I didn't mention it when I was talking. 50% of people over age 85. Will develop Alzheimer's disease. But that number could change. And in fact, at the International Meeting on Alzheimer's Disease, they actually said that incidence is dropping. The absolute number of Alzheimer's cases will increase, but because there will be so many more people that are over age 85, that's an expansion of that population. But the incidence, you know, of 10 people who are 85 years old, how many will have AD? It'll drop, and that's because we're learning more about, well, better imaging, better treatment, and of course, people like you are going to try to lower their risk factors. It's a good question.
Thank you.
I just have a quick comment about hearing loss and also chemotherapy, because some chemotherapies will definitely lead to hearing loss, and so be careful after that to do something about your hearing.
Right.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program for one more question, and I'm sure that Patricia will stay afterwards to catch those that we couldn't tonight.
I wondered if you have a thought about moderate consumption of alcohol. I know it depletes B vitamins, so earlier you mentioned these are kind of all interwoven.
You know, it's a good question to end up with, because wine was served tonight. A glass of wine for a woman, or maybe as many as two for a man, actually is correlated with good cognitive function, unless you have a problem with alcohol and, you know, alcoholism. And you're absolutely right, high alcohol consumption depletes the B vitamins, but a single glass of wine with a spinach salad does not. And And of course, red wine has resveratrol, which increases something called sirtuin, sirtuin 1, which is good for cognitive function, although it turns out you'd have to drink a lot of red wine to get the, to get the boost that's detectable. But yes, very moderate alcohol consumption, particularly wine rather than spirits, is fine so long as it's not contraindicated by other risks. And that's a good way to end. And somebody's phone is really funny. Thank you so much. And I always learn something, so thank you so much.
Our thanks to Patricia Spillman for her comments today. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 114th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.